Hi, and welcome to another episode of The Leadership Enigma. Listen, I love this podcast because I have an amazing opportunity to talk to incredible people. And this episode is no different. We are sailing towards episode 200 and something, which itself is kind of bonkers considering this was a lockdown project. But if you're watching or listening to us for the first time, where have you been? And there's a lot of great material for you to check out. So we are on all of the podcast platforms and you'll find us now also on YouTube with over 270 videos. But trust me, you do not want to miss this particular episode because I am going to be talking to the wonderful Kelly Latimer. Now, she's a trailblazer and a test pilot and a pioneer in the world of aerospace. Kelly has flown some of the most cutting-edge aircraft for NASA and Virgin Galactic, and we'll be chatting about how she's pushed the limits of human flight. So, from military cockpit to commercial space ventures, she's led, she's taken risks, and she's reflected with me now on a career of immense personal satisfaction before she goes on holiday. And if anyone's really listening to this of our previous guest, this is all Dan's fault, and you'll hear more about that during the episode. Listen, don't miss out on this amazing episode. Come back to me just after this break. Hi, I'm Adam Pacifico, and welcome to The Leadership Enigma, a world-ranked, award-winning podcast that's insatiably curious as regards what leaders do, how they do it, and importantly, why. We'll delve into the human doing, but even deeper into the human being and the power of human-centered leadership to drive sustainable change. So whether you're an entrepreneur, business owner, corporate executive, each week we speak to global experts, academics, rising stars, ambitious upstarts, and disruptors, as together we will discover that success leaves clues. Kelly, it's a warm and aerospace type of welcome to the Leadership Enigma. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I am very well, and I've been very excited to have this conversation with you. Now, I know it's morning for you, and I did a little bit of an excited introduction there. But I have to say, I've never had yet, out of all of the episodes, which is why I'm always excited, a test pilot. Someone who's a test pilot was formerly, I think, for Boeing as well, right? And NASA,
yeah.
And Virgin Galactic. Just help us understand, what is a test pilot?
So basically a test pilot takes out an aircraft that's had some kind of modification or a brand new aircraft and takes it through a flight test. And a flight test basically, you know, as a vehicle gets designed and built, there's certain things you have to prove in order to, you know, if it's supposed to be, let's say, a spaceship, you know, you start off with just the very small piece of flight, you know, just a small airspeed envelope, and you fly, you collect a bunch of data, the engineers look at it, they clear it, you go on to the next thing. And so basically you just take an aircraft or any system, you know, through a series of tests. And the whole goal is just to collect data so you can validate your models and validate how it performs, you know, validate its structure, validate the speed it can handle, validate how it handles for the pilots. It's always fascinating because every, you know, I've done a lot of test projects and everyone is completely different. Wow. So it's always an exciting venture every time I started something new.
Well, this is very much out of my sphere of expertise now, Claire, I must admit. So thank you for that definition. So help me understand, when you talk about you're the test pilot of a number of these craft, what kind of aircraft are we talking about? Because people will be thinking of commercial airliners and what we know. So what are you talking about?
So my background, I started in the military. So I flew small supersonic trainer jet aircraft, and then I went on to fly big cargo. So my experience is similar to commercial aircraft, you know, primarily big cargo. So like for the military, it's big four engine jet cargo aircraft and yep. Tankers. And then for Boeing was the same thing. I did pretty much Boeing's military side of it. And then when I got with Virgin Galactic, of course, it was different because there it was a spaceship. You know? So going from something large down to something small that's a kind of a glider, but also a spaceship, but also kind of like a fighter. So, yeah, it's been pretty varied.
You've used that intriguing word, Kelly, spaceship, and I'm going to come back to that. let me just deal with this, though, because you've got a wonderful background behind you as well. So some people might be thinking, are you an astronaut? Is that what you did? Were you an astronaut? But that's something slightly different, isn't it? Help us understand the nuance to this.
So I actually am. So technically I'm an astronaut. So I got above the 50-mile line. So yeah, I do get to carry the title astronaut, but it's a difference. You know, what we did is we were trying to, or still in the process of opening space for the normal person. So it's a very short flight. It's basically straight up out of the atmosphere, zero gravity view of the planet, and then right back down. So it's about all in, you know, the time and space is about 5 minutes versus, let's say, like a NASA astronaut, where you go up for days at a time, you're up for months at a time, and you're actually working in space. We're basically just kind of hitting space, getting the experience, and coming back down.
This is space tourism we're talking about, really, isn't it?
It is, yes. That's the goal of Virgin Galactic's tourism, and to kind of open up the experience to more and more people.
Now we know there are a number of iconic leaders who are racing to really be at the forefront of space tourism. But let me go backwards again. I always say this. Let me go backwards to go forwards. Had you always wanted to be an astronaut? Had you always wanted to do this?
I did, yeah. Ever since, you know, it's one of those things where people ask me, well, when did it start? I'm like, I don't know, because I don't ever remember not wanting to do it. So of course, as a kid, you know, I grew up very young in the late 60s, early 70s. I watched, you know, the Apollo launches. I watched the beginning of the space shuttle program. And so I kind of, you know, when I was in eighth grade, decided that was going to be my career, what I wanted to do. So I read about astronauts in the encyclopedia, and I crafted this whole plan to go to the Air Force, be a test pilot, and then be an astronaut. So I kind of had this long-term plan from like when I was really young.
Were there influences around you that were fueling that enthusiasm within family, friends? Where was that coming from? Or had you just as a little girl seen something and thought, I want to do that?
I actually just saw it, and honestly, I didn't really tell people because I thought they would think I was nuts, you know, and they'd be like, astronaut, you're not going to be an astronaut. And I was like, I don't really want to hear it because I got a plan, you know. So it mostly was what I watched and saw on TV, you know, just the progression of the US space program. And then, you know, as far as people, of course, when Sally Ride went, that was the first US woman, and that was a huge deal. And then, you know, as I got into my career, you know, Eileen Collins was kind of that next iconic person that I watched, because she was the first one to be, you know, a space shuttle pilot and commander, and she is just an amazing person. So she's someone I had always kind of watched through my career, you know, to see how she was doing.
Did you ever get a chance to meet some of these people, to meet some of your? I'm always intrigued as to whether people have role models and idols, and then they go on to achieve what they achieve, and then they meet those people.
Yeah, I actually did get to meet Eileen. It was when I was with Virgin Galactic and Virgin Orbit, and I was in Long Beach, and she came out and she was giving a leadership talk.
Right.
And someone's like, have you ever met Eileen Collins? I was like, no, I've got to go. So I went and met her, and we had a long conversation. And she is just such a genuine, you know, like humble person with this amazing background. So yeah, I did finally get to meet her.
Well, that's a great segue because you spoke about leadership, and this is the Leadership Enigma. So I really want to now pry as best I can in relation to some of the lessons that you picked up. Let me go to your military days, because you're a combat veteran, but you served on tours as well, I believe, in Afghanistan and Iraq. But you ended up as a very senior officer, didn't you, within the military, and leading lots and lots of people. Just give us some context around that.
So my last 2 years in the military, I was a squadron commander, and also a combined test force commander. So basically, I had talked about doing flight tests of those large vehicles. Well, there's the 418th Flight Test Squadron in the Air Force, which basically tests all the tankers, the transports. We also had some special ops and helicopters under us. So I ended up as the leader of, essentially, it was about a 720 person unit that was comprised of military, civilian, government civilians, and contractors. So it was a big job, you know, running all these different test programs for the Air Force, just in, you know, in conjunction with large aircraft.
When you're leading that many people and you've got multiple stakeholders, in fact, you've got multiple agencies all working together, are there some standout experiences or lessons that you had leading such an eclectic group of people? Because there's going to be many, many leaders who are listening to this and watching this and think themselves, I've got disparate groups of people all over the world, and they've all got different disciplines and different expertise, and I'm trying to galvanize. How do you do that?
Yeah, it's a challenge, because some of the people, you know, like not everybody directly reported to me. So I was, you know, officially in charge of the military members. And then, of course, the contractors I didn't actually own. They were on contract with the program offices, but I was in charge of helping them get their programs done in conjunction with us. And then, same thing, the government civilians that were under me, I had sort of operational control of, but they actually belonged to technically they reported up to a different chain through the civilian construct. So yeah, it was very challenging, and I think probably the biggest thing was just communication and continually keeping in touch with each of these different units and having continual conversations with both contractors as well as like the military people. It actually was fairly easy because
Right.
that construct was there
The
already.
chain
It
of
was more of a
command.
challenge, yeah, to keep the relation with the contractors because, of course, they're somewhat different motivated, right? They have a contract, they're answering to their superiors, and it may not always match with the military members saying, hey, this isn't good enough. This isn't good for the war fighter. And the contractor's like, well, that was our contract. So, yeah, negotiating those was really interesting. And it was a matter of always keeping my leadership informed as like problems or issues were arising and to try and jump on things early, kind of seeing them coming where there's going to be a conflict and get on it early. And I think, one of the earliest lessons I had in leading that, because it can get very contentious. It can get very, hey, this isn't right. You guys aren't helping us. Was when I was young and new test pilots, and we were working on a program, and we weren't happy with how the aircraft was operating. It wasn't going to do the job. And meanwhile, there's other agencies that are like, no, it's fine. And so, I got our commander involved, and I was like, hey, we've got to have this meeting now. And we were all very passionate about it. And, we get on this phone call, and I'm ready for him to just lay into these guys and say, no, this isn't right and everything. And he gets on the phone, and he goes, okay, how can we help you? And I was like, well, that wasn't what I was expecting,
Taken by
And so
surprise.
what I kind of learned was that, don't come at it with guns blazing and we have our point, you don't. Come at it from everybody has their objective, but we all in the end have the same thing. We all in the end want this aircraft or this system to work for the people who are going to use it. But we do have different masters and different motivations, but let's calmly talk about, where everybody is, where the issues are, and how we go forward. So that was a huge lesson for me because I had seen some passionate leaders come in, fire and brimstone on a meeting, and it really didn't get anywhere. It kind of made it worse. And so that was I think that was always extremely helpful for me through my actually entire career and any time I was in charge or leading or just even in a meeting about stuff. It's just like, let's talk about it. Let's find out where everybody is, and let's figure out how we all get on the same page and go forward.
Well, a lot of people, including myself, we have preconceived ideas in relation to what leading in the military might look or feel like. In a post-pandemic environment, so many people are reporting an increased need for meaning and connection. What was the kind of leader that you felt you naturally were when it came to connecting with people, finding common areas, and as you say, working with quite eclectic groups, as you've described? What was the leader that you became? In that space of trying to create meaning, connection, and collaboration.
Yeah, I think for me, like that's the piece that comes more natural because I like that. That's the
Right.
thing. It was always challenging, I think, to be a leader because I kind of hate to actually be out in front and all of that. But I think what I liked was the going around. Like I was always there late at night to see who was there late at night. Like who are the people that are staying and go talk to them. Like, hey, why are you still here? What can we do to, get you out of here earlier? Or just sit in on the meetings and be like, hey, I'm not in the meeting to, I'm just in the meeting to watch it happen. I'm not here to take charge or anything, but just I really liked that being in on all of the different aspects of people's normal lives, each of the projects, how they were progressing. And then the biggest thing was just it's so helpful to let people know that you're open. I mean, I had that open door policy, like, hey, anytime, come on in. And I really, I mean it, just come in and talk and no harm, no foul, because I'm better off knowing what's going on than having things, blow up later. So I think for me, that piece of it was very natural. The part I always found hard was the other side of that, where if you have people that are non-performers or if you have someone's not showing up, they're late, like it's those things you hate to deal with that you actually have to because everyone is still watching. I mean, they watch how you're in and creating teamwork and stuff and, motivating people and rewarding people, but they also watch what you're doing with the non-performers because
Yeah.
that's just as important. If you just sweep it under the carpet, let it go and keep a problem. But it's just for me, that's always so hard to deal with because I hate being hard on people, but sometimes you have to do it for the good, of the entire unit and operation.
Well, let's dwell on that because a lot of leaders say they find that difficult. And I had some wonderful advice from Carol Korfman, who was a guest a while back now. So who always said, and this really resonates with people, she always said, listen, as a leader, you're going to have to challenge. But if you challenge this much, then you've got to care this much. And if you challenge this much, then you've got to care this much. And that really resonates with people. So how did you knew full well that you had to, but how did you go about that approach of you're going to have to challenge, you're going to have to tackle non-performance or behavior that falls below the line? How did you find that in yourself? Because it's not instinctively who you are to be able to deal with that.
Yeah. I mean, first thing is I'd go to kind of the other leaders, you know, because there are other squadron commanders and stuff, and have the talk like, okay, how have you been handling this? I'd go to my superiors on, I have this issue, I know I need to. And I would get a little advice, because I didn't just want to kind of go into it blind. So I'd get a little bit of advice on how to handle it. And the biggest thing is you just start first, you know, directly, you know, confronting the issue, and then, you know, start documenting and taking steps along the way, so that you kind of set things up. You're not just coming out of the blue and, you know, you're fired or something. It's been a process, and you started it. And you have the uncomfortable conversations, you know, but that's what everyone told me, was just address it now, begin, you know, start somewhere, and then just continue to progress. And if it doesn't change, then, you know, you have the wherewithal to take action.
And as you say, there's a lot of respect for a leader that will actually embrace the difficult conversations. And there's always a consequence to not having the conversation as well, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
So you said something else which piqued my interest, Kelly, was you talked about that you sometimes went to meetings, but you weren't involved and your door was always open. One of the eight components of human-centered leadership, something that I'm working on, is presence. And sometimes it's just being around, not speaking, not having an active role. What did you see as the power of just sometimes presence, from both maybe being in the cockpit or being in a meeting room or a briefing room? Tell me a little bit about your thoughts about sometimes just the leader being present.
I think the biggest impact is everyone knows that you really care. You know, you're not just saying those things. You're not saying, hey, I'm really interested in this, and then boom, you're out the door and, you know, I'll check in with you later. But they see and know that you actually care. You are interested, that you have as much a stake in this as they do.
I'm interested that you just linked it to care, because I'm also intrigued as to how do you find yourself over-rotating to care when you're working in a military context, where you're working in a high stakes environment, which is pretty much been your entire career, Kelly, let's be honest.
Yeah.
how do you balance that care with the immense risk or jeopardy that's in the system innately because of the work you do?
Yeah, I think it was helpful to me that I had come up, you know, before actually, you know, being a leader and stuff, I had already, before being kind of like a bigger leader, I had come through already, like, you know, from flying, being an instructor, you know, in high performance jets, you know, flying cargo all around the world in combat environments, you know, to testing. And so I think I had already had that background. And it really, what it all is about is risk management, right? It's about managing the risk. Like, we have to get someplace. You can't be 100% safe, or you'll never do anything. So you have to go forward. But I think, like, the fact that the other thing too is we are doing these high risk things, and the fact that people see you there in the meetings and engaged all the way through, they know that you understand those risks too, and you do care about them. And that also gives them confidence that you're knowledgeable enough. When I say I've signed that plan and you're good to go do this, they know that I actually know what I'm talking about and I've read it. I'm not just like, oh, it sounds good to me, you know, go get it. So
there's a real power to sometimes just you being available, visible, but you're not having to do anything, or you're not having to have all of the answers or even say anything. It's just that presence. Yes.
Yes. And I, you know, I'll tell you, and one of the times I learned that was, again, kind of early on when I had my very first mission. I was a young captain, and we had a you know, big military transport, and we basically had a 3-week mission. It's the same crew. A lot of times on these longer missions, it's a bigger crew, because you have like examiners, instructors, and people are getting training and stuff. So, you know, I had a fairly large crew. It was my first time doing it. And I think this is the time I realized the difference of being in charge and leading. Like, they're not the same thing. You can be in charge and not lead. And you actually don't have to be in charge to lead. But this, we were about a week into this mission, I could tell it wasn't going well. I had a number of enlisted members, senior enlisted. You know, I had a pilot more senior to me, another one junior. And I think I had sort of been on like autopilot, like, oh, everyone knows the mission. This is just going to happen. So we would walk in and do things. And I could tell everybody was kind of really mad and kind of disgruntled. And so I went to the two senior non-commissioned officers. I was like, hey, I can tell this is not going well. Do you guys want to meet with me after we, you know, get to the hotel and just let me know, quite frankly, what I'm doing wrong? And so we sat down, they kind of looked at me and they were like, well, and I was like, just pull the gun out and shoot me in the face. Like, just tell me exactly. And the most senior enlisted guy said, ma'am, you have not been leading this mission. And I'm talking all the way back to the briefing. And I was like, wow. And it is just that. It is like, yeah, I showed up and gave everybody, here's the schedule, here we go. And then that was it. And then we all showed up and okay, here's our thing. But it wasn't like, all right, everybody, from the beginning, here's how we're gonna, handle our, like, just how we would use names off base, because we would be in a civilian environment. It's like, do we use first names? Do we use last names? Is it okay if we all hang out together because we're officer enlisted? Like, just from the beginning, what is the plan? And then every time we stop, not just here's the thing right now, but here's the overall plan. Here's what's coming down the line. I'm going to get feedback. And they're like, you never talked about how we were going to communicate. Like, if we had issues with somebody, because, one of the guys are like an 18-year-old, kid out of high school, his first mission. And they're like, we never talked about how, if he has an issue, how we're going to address that. And I was like, wow. And that made me realize that, yeah, you need to be engaged throughout, even if you're not, you don't have to continually direct, but just be in touch and know what's going on and have communication avenues already set up. But that was just, it was a huge thing because I was so deflated. I was like, oh, I'm terrible at this. But I mean, it was a game changer for me on really understanding when you're leading, you need to know everything and have plans for all contingencies and really be far more open and communicative.
That's pretty candid feedback, isn't it? But obviously
That's
powerful
great.
because you're now telling the story. And
Yeah.
excuse me, and that's had an impact on you. Kelly, I've got to take advantage because you said you have passed the definition of astronaut. So it's not every day that I get to chat to an astronaut. So we're going to have to focus on that. Come on, because everyone watching and listening is going to say, hang on,
Yeah.
Kelly's an astronaut. Let's get to the astronaut bit. I before we get to actually the kind of the what's it really like to be an astronaut or fly in a spaceship. You took the job at Virgin Galactic after there had already been an accident. I think, now help me with dates here. I think it was the VSS Enterprise,
Yes.
31st, it says on my screen, 2014. There was a catastrophic flight breakup during a test flight in the Mojave Desert. I believe there was a fatality and there was a serious injury. Now, you take the job after that incident, correct?
Correct. Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. So obviously I did my due diligence because I had seen all the press about the accident, read what I could and everything. And then it was about a year later that Virgin Galactic at this point said, hey, we're not giving up. We're pressing forward. We are in the process of building the next vehicle. We're building a new team. And so they actually invited me to come down for a day, like not interview, just a day to talk with everybody. And I asked all the questions like, what actually happened? How do we know it's not going to happen again? Are there other things behind there? What is the plan? And they're like, nope, we're building an entire team. We've looked at it. We know what happened. We have a way to address it. We've actually scoped other areas of the vehicle, with kind of open eyes to say, are there other issues? And so after a day, I was like, wow, these guys. One, they're professionals. They're all, test professionals. They're aerospace professionals, highly experienced. They know what they're talking about. They have a great plan. And I was like, they are going to do this and they're going to be successful.
Now that's quite interesting. I'm being very British when I said it, aren't I? Because I think you said you had access to NTSB, so external data. You'd listen to their learning from it as well, and actually you were enthused by it, weren't you? So even off the back of a catastrophic and fatal incident, you were of the view much learning had taken place, and actually this was something that you wanted to do. Is that the almost young girl astronaut in you who wants to push the envelope? Help me balance almost the emotional and the
Yeah, I
intellectual.
mean, it is, so I had actually, I had that whole career to be a NASA astronaut, and I actually did interview, and I got denied because I have this like blood reading that, I may never notice it in my life, but for them, like, it's absolutely disqualifying and you can't change it. And I was like, wow, okay, that's really disheartening, so I had kind of already had that. I thought I was there, I was down like that last phone call. And I was like, wow. And so I had kind of, been deflated, thought it was never going to happen. And I was kind of watching Virgin and I saw the action. I go, oh man. And then a friend of mine, from there called and said, hey, we're going to hire some pilots. And he's like, if you ever thought you wanted to do this, he's like, now is the time because we're only going to hire one, maybe two more. And I was like, okay, the dream is still alive. I'm not giving up. Let me go find out and do my due diligence. And so, yeah, I mean, it's one, as I looked, they have a plan, they know what happened, they're ready to go forward. It's still risky, but it's something I pursued, my whole
Yeah.
life, and here it is again. So I can't say no.
Nothing's without risk, let's be honest. Now,
Yep.
Kelly. So help us understand. You said yes to Virgin Galactic. What were you saying yes to? What were you about to fly for the first time?
Yeah, so coming on, they have so basically the way it works is there's two vehicles. So there's a mothership, VMS Eve. So there's Eve, the mothership, and then there's the spaceship. So Eve carries the spaceship, basically under the center wing, up to an altitude, drops the spaceship. The spaceship lights the rocket motor, goes straight up space, comes back in, and lands on a runway. So the whole operation takes place on a runway. So as I got hired, I was hired to be a spaceship pilot, but first you start by flying the mothership. So
Eve.
the first thing I do is get qualified, and flying Eve, which if you've ever seen her, one off, one of a kind, scale composite, beautiful design, two fuselages, a center wing, really challenging to fly.
Right.
So that's always, for a pilot, that's always fun because it's not easy. So a really challenging aircraft to fly, but a beautiful aircraft. So I got to fly that first. And then the plan was we were going to be flying. We rolled the vehicle out, but as all development programs, it takes many more years than what you think. And so in that time frame, we also started the Launcher One program, and that's the piece that eventually became Virgin Orbit. So since I was the big aircraft experienced person, I became the lead pilot on the 747, and it was a big 747
Yes.
modified to carry a liquid fueled rocket on the wing. So I became the lead pilot for that. And then when they split the companies in two, I just stayed like kind of on contract with Virgin Orbit to at least get all their initial testing and first few launches done. And then I came back to VG and got to fly the spaceship.
So many questions, Kelly.
I know.
So
It's a lot.
you're flying Eve the, I can't believe I've been having this conversation. That's why I love this podcast. You're flying Eve the mothership, which is a bespoke, as you say, and not very easy aircraft to fly. What altitude did that go to before it let the spaceship go? What height were you at with Eve?
Yeah, so with the spaceship, we drop up, basically like the 40,000s, like 40, 41, 42,000, up to, a max of 45.
Okay.
Without the spaceship, it has a lot of lift and it can go all the way up to 53,000 feet. So we've headed up pretty high on its own, but with the spaceship, you're limited to about 40, 45-ish thousand feet or so. And
Okay.
so the drop will be somewhere in there depending on the speed you need.
And people who have flown commercial aircraft, they can they're on many occasions in the 30,000 feet, aren't they, altitude wise?
Yeah. Sometimes you go, if you're going over storms, you go a little bit higher. So most airliners can get up to like 40,000, 41 or so. So we're just a little bit above that. But the 53 is kind of cool because that's quite a bit above that.
So, what is a noticeable difference at 53,000 feet, if any?
The biggest thing is, there isn't much air up there. And so as you get to higher speeds, you get pretty close to where your speed limit and your stall limit are the same, and the vehicle doesn't, perform as well because there just isn't as much air up there for the wing.
Right.
So it's a little bit slower operating. But again, the vehicle is basically designed to pretty much take off and drop a spaceship. So you don't need a whole bunch of, it's not like a military type aircraft. We need a lot of maneuvering up at those altitudes.
Gotcha. Okay, so you're at 53,000 feet is probably the highest for Eve, but then you were actually able to fly the spaceship itself. The fact that I'm even saying the word spaceship, Kelly, is great. What's the height that the spaceship can go to?
Yeah, so the spaceship goes up to about 55 miles. I mean, that's usually a better thing than feet. So 55, about 55 miles up.
Okay, I'm
And it basically
trying.
goes straight up. It gets dropped, accelerates out, turns the corner, and just straight up to, somewhere around 55 miles, and then comes straight back down and lands on the runway.
Wow. Let me ask you this question. At what point are you starting to fly into darkness and see the curvature of the Earth? I joked with you, didn't I, Kelly? I said, you're never going to be invited to a flat Earth conference, are you? So at what point do you start to see things that, let's be honest, most humans will never see?
Yeah, so we don't actually see the curvature that we don't see until we turn the vehicle around. So I'll just take it through the profile.
Okay.
So first of all, you get so it's kind of nice because you're just like the mothership is doing all the work as you're getting carried up. It takes about 45 minutes for the mothership to basically get to the altitude, and we have a running because you're essentially facing the runway. So we get dropped, go up, and then just land straight ahead.
Right.
But once you get dropped, it's like everything's calm and serene and peaceful. And then you get dropped. We light the rocket motor right away, and it is the most crazy, incredible acceleration anyone will ever feel. Because it's a small vehicle. I mean, the beauty of getting the airdrop and having a short duration mission is it's a very small vehicle, but you have 70,000 pounds of thrust, and it's like a 3G, which is like three times the force of gravity going straight forward. And so it is just a crazy, crazy acceleration ride. It's very smooth, but it is just crazy acceleration. We get just past supersonic and you feel a little bit of a burble. And then we basically, it's hand flown, which is
Wow.
pretty incredible these days. So the pilot will run the stabilizer in the back to a certain setting. The vehicle pitches straight up. And at that point, you're still accelerating because as we burn the propellant, we get lighter, but it's the same thrust. So we're going faster and faster as you turn the corner. And it
Upwards.
is just the most insane, insane feeling. And then what you see is you see the bright blue sky become like a dark blue. And then you just see the black kind of come down
Wow.
amongst the window until all you're seeing is just pure black outside, and it's not like a color black, or a paint. It's like a void of anything black. It's really interesting. It's like this deep black. And then once we the rocket motor shuts off, and then we rotate the vehicle around, and at that point you see the planet come into view. You see the horizon, the curvature, and it is like the most brilliant object you'll ever see. And it's clear from 50 miles up. I can look down and see the 2-mile-long runway. It's crystal clear. You can see the atmosphere, and you just look outside and it's the biggest object up close that you'll ever see in your life. And it's magnificent. You look down, you just like it's spellbinding,
You've flown your entire life, but what is that like when the spaceship pitches round and you start to see the planet for the first time in that way? I mean, it sounds like that must take your breath away, even as a
Yeah, I mean
experienced pilot.
it's surreal. And then as the pilot, you kind of go through because you're still in charge of this vehicle and getting everything done. There's procedures, and we're getting systems, we're shutting the rocket motor down, we're getting other systems ready for the re-entry. And so I don't think it's I think the people in the back probably have a better, longer experience, because I remember being busy and being like, look outside. I was like, I can't believe that. And then I'd be back inside doing stuff and then look outside again. So it was actually my second flight that I think I saw more and realized more than my first flight, because it was from the pilot perspective, it was so fast that first flight because I was so busy doing
I
everything,
bet.
like running these checklists actually for the first time in the vehicle. So the second time I got to experience more, but you're still always like, okay, come back down, get this, get that. Okay, check on this. All right, look outside one more time. I can't believe it. Then you get
Did
back to getting busy.
you have space tourists on board, or did you have other people of the company, or did you have people with you, or was it just a
We
test
did. We
flight
had it
pilot?
was yeah. All my flights were space tourists, and we had a company astronaut instructor on board. At least the flights I did, and then the later flights, it was just the space tourists in the back and no
Gotcha.
astronaut instructor.
At what height is weightlessness a factor?
It really happens because the rocket motor cuts off, so it's not so much because you can actually fly. You know how they have like the nickname is the vomit comet that NASA uses, where they do you basically take an airplane and you just push it over and people float in the back.
Right.
So really the zero gravity is the fact that we had all this acceleration and then you cut the motor off and then you get zero gravity. So essentially, well before we hit the apogee or the highest point, everybody in the back is zero gravity. So as soon as the rocket motor cuts off, we clear everybody to unstrap, float around. So we're still going up, but because there's no rocket motor, and then you don't actually experience gravity until we come back down the atmosphere and you get the force of drag, and then everybody begins to sink down in their seats as you come back into gravity.
Were you able as the pilot to experience that, Kelly, or is there no time for such
No, well, I
things?
mean, we stayed strapped in, but honestly, it was a very relaxing feeling. I was expecting when the rocket motor shut off to have a big jolt, and
Right.
it actually was very, it was very, it was just very smooth. It was just a smooth transition to just like we're in our straps, we're just kind of floating there. And of course, we had everything tethered down at front, but the checklist is floating up. I was like, oh, look at that.
I want to ask you, I mean, firstly, thank you for explaining that. What a wonderful conversation to have. I hope everyone's enjoying that. Let me ask you a question, because I know we chatted about this briefly last week, that if you're the pilot, you may not actually be the leader But a lot of people will look to you, especially when you're talking about the mission and planning it. We talked about the fact that you might not be the leader of the business or the operation, but as the pilot, everyone is going to look to you. So you're almost leader without authority. Tell me what that felt like, because you really have been in senior leadership roles, but then maybe you found yourself in this leader with no authority, but you are the pilot, so people are deferring to you. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It's kind of, I guess you might call it, like, informal leadership.
Yeah.
But it's one of those things where, the whole company is geared towards building this vehicle, and the most, visible user and person that actually gets to do it, is the pilot.
Yeah.
So you just sort of automatically become the people, the one that everyone looks to for, like, the confidence, or, like, things like, hey, we had an accident or something didn't go right. And immediately it's like, what do the pilots think?
Right.
And so it was always extremely important for us to be, like, confident, never negative to people, degrading, even things like we would do simulator sessions to practice. We would fail all sorts of systems, but it was practice for the pilots. It was practice for the engineers that are watching all of the data. And of course, the first time we would do it, it would never come out, white. And I've seen in my previous career, not at Virgin Galactic, because all the pilots there were extremely professional and they were all already leaders.
Yep.
But, the pilot kind of berating people on their performance, and there's just nothing worse than that. So it was always important to be like, okay, that did not go at all like we planned, but that's why we do this. That's why we practice. Let's just walk through it, and to go through and be thorough and hit what happened, maybe who didn't, make the right call and everything. Okay, how do we do it? And let's get together and go do it again. But it's so important to sort of keep everybody together, keep that positive while still giving the feedback, and just kind of showing that confidence. And same thing for risk acceptance, that, hey, in those meetings, there's always a pilot in those meetings on, and we give our concerns and everything. And it was important. Everyone's looking to say, are the pilots, happy with this? And so, yeah, it's a big deal, especially like Virgin Galactic, where it's a small pilot corps, but it was so, kind of so out there and so upfront in everyone's mind.
Well, this is interesting as well, isn't it? Because so everyone knows who is at the head of Virgin Galactic, and it's an iconic person, especially from a British perspective. So it's a Richard Branson, very iconic figurehead, and a leader in his own right, and someone that this certainly nation holds in very high regard in relation to what he's done and how he's done it. But from the pilot perspective, this is interesting. Talk to me a bit about the role of the role model, because I'm assuming that regardless of all of that, people are always still looking at you, looking at the pilot. What's the pilot? How's the pilot reacting? What's the body language? What's the pilot saying or not saying? So did you always feel that I'm always being watched? Because a lot of leaders say they know that they're always being watched. So how they show up is incredibly important. What are your thoughts on that? That you were always going to be watched because you were the pilot of the spaceship.
Yep, absolutely. And I think it came, we kind of go back to that meeting thing in particular, where there would be these meetings. And again, there may be some contentious where, hey, we don't have the schedule and budget for something, but we really need to fix this on the vehicle. Or if we don't, what are the plans? And you can get, like operations and engineering, versus, management and schedule budget and stuff. And again, everyone's looking. So if you're the pilot, you come in, same thing, guns blazing, we're not going to fly this or do that, completely the wrong way to go, because everyone's watching you and people will jump into different camps. It's like, okay, let's talk about this. Like, here's my big concern, and just be straight up with, these are big concerns. These are some concerns. I'm not worried about that, but let's start working through this. And again, being that kind of calm, let's deal with the facts. Let's talk about the risk. Let's talk about how we mitigate it. Let's talk about worst case scenarios. Let's bring it out and talk about it. Let's, work through, what is a build up plan to get there? But again, because everyone's looking at you. And if you come down like, management's crazy, there's no way we can do that, terrible, because you turn, half the people against, other people in the company. So yeah, I think it's a huge deal. I think it's extremely important, because you can sway a lot of people into being angry or addressing the problem together and fixing it.
It's funny, isn't it? And sometimes it's what you don't say as opposed to what you say. You can't win in any respect. Kelly, let me ask you this. With all of the experiences that you've had, with all the incredible flights that you've taken, is there one that stands out for you that you're really proud of? Is that even a fair question?
There's no doubt, as far as like the flight would be my first spaceship flight.
Right.
I mean, it was like a lifetime pursuit, but it met up to one of my expectations. It was spectacular. It was thrilling. It was incredibly beautiful. It was everything. So yeah, that first spaceship flight, that'd be the one.
Did you, here's a really ridiculous question, Kelly. Did you manage to take any photos yourself whilst you were up there?
No, well, the vehicle has a bunch of cameras because it's,
Right.
since it's space tourism, yeah, there's a number of cameras and yeah, and photos and pictures and stuff. And on the ground too, we had done a couple of selfies, like myself and the other pilot, so we always, yeah, we have those.
Well, you have to send me one of those, Kelly, so we can add it into
All
to how we market this episode. There's something else I want to ask you, and that's from a kind of a, one of the other components of the human centered leader model that I've got is in relation to inclusivity. So I want to ask, you're working in a very male dominated field. I'm thinking combat aviation, space flight, and if I'm wrong, you'll tell me. So kind of what have you learned from being a pioneer and a real role model? Just for anybody, but also especially for young girls who are saying, hang on, I want to do that. You know, you talked about you looking at, was it Evelyn Collins, and thinking, I want to be just like that person. So you're a role model. So, kind of, what advice would you give for leaders striving to create more diversity in their teams and more inclusivity in their teams? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, one, just from the perspective of, being kind of the minority or the only, woman or only, girl in the thing is, one thing I learned was to kind of try and not put the pressure on myself. Like I always felt like everyone's looking at me and maybe they're not. And sometimes, I go for the first space flight and it's like, I'm the only woman, everyone's looking at me. And I'm like, I bet these guys all have the exact same pressure. They're like, this is the biggest flight of my life, And so most likely some of the pressure I put on myself is probably self-inflicted. And, but in the end, it does feel a lot of stress, a lot of pressure. And then, so in the end, I would just tell myself, just, be competent what you're supposed to do your job, do it well, and then don't worry about the rest. But as far as being able to progress and stuff, I mean, I would say it's very dependent on not only like the leaders above to make sure that they are sending the message down that, hey, this is Kelly's here, she's qualified, she is capable of doing this, and I fully support. It's also your peers, and leaders that are kind of with you, and also your subordinates and stuff. So it you are fairly dependent on the leadership of the people above, with, and below you, because without that, it's difficult. And again, I think all you can do if you have people that aren't supporting you is just be competent, do your job, do it well, be thorough, and that's the best you can do. And do it as yourself. Like I always remember thinking to myself, like don't act like I think a man would. Just be me as the leader. Don't
Right.
be me being a man as the leader, just be me as the leader, with the traits I have, and I have my strengths and I have my weaknesses, and deal with both of those.
Now, I know you're very humble as well, actually, Kelly, but I want you, we did talk last week, and you, we always get feedback as leaders, don't we? And I know that you got some feedback, didn't you, when you left your squadron? And that was something that was very heartwarming for you, and you remember very fondly. Just share that again. What did you experience when you finally left that particular role of over 700 from the squadron?
Yeah, it was a, it was one of those jobs when I took it, like my, you talk about your comfort zone is and where it's not. My comfort zone is being a pilot, being in charge, being a leader, running big organizations. I mean, it's exhausting. It's a full-time job, and it's, to me, it's very intimidating. So after the 2 years, we do a change of command ceremony. So basically, you have the two commanders, the outgoing, the ingoing. You've got the wing leadership there, to kind of do the change of command. You've got everybody in the audience and stuff. And so basically, we had a building and a hangar. And so the ceremony was in a hangar. So you just basically walk out. So we had a whole thing. I had my secretary had the schedule. Go, okay, we're going to walk out at this time. And like, my parents were there, and my friends were there, and like everybody in the wing is there. And so, so as I come walking out, no one had ever done this before, but the squadron, unbeknownst to me, had all formed up like in two lines for the area I was going to walk across. They got called to attention. They all saluted as I walked through, and it had never been done before. And they did it like for me, and I was just so, yeah. I mean, I get emotional now. It's just so touching. It's such a like a vindication of I did a good job.
Your own
People
guard,
realized
your
it.
own guard of honor, I think, Kelly. Is that what
Yes,
we could
yeah, it was.
describe
And
that?
all I remember is as I'm walking through, I had to give a little speech. I was like, "Don't cry, don't cry, don't cry. Cry later. Suck it up. Get through this." But I was so touched by that. Yeah, I think that was probably One of the cool, I mean, there was my coolest flight ever, then that was probably one of my best moments ever.
Wow. So, Kelly, with such an amazing career, what's next for you?
Yeah, so currently I'm retired surfing. I'm going to a yoga retreat in Bali.
I love.
So
Well,
initially, yeah, initially I'm just the time off. I retired in May. And part of it was, we did the spaceship flights, and the company has taken time now to go back down, move on to the next vehicle, design it. And I was like, whew, I kind of had this whole career and got to do, what I wanted to do, and to kind of go back again. I was like, oh, maybe it's time to retire, So, and I've been looking forward to traveling and all those things I'd put off forever, that I kept saying, oh, later, next year, and just get involved and get busy, and next thing time goes by. So yeah, right now I'm just traveling a lot and surfing a lot and
Well,
doing yoga,
I nothing
cooking
wrong
for
with
the
any of
first time in a long time.
well, I just I love the fact that actually I'm chatting to an astronaut who's talking about the love of travel, because you've been to space and back, and who knows? Bali sounds very nice as well. Here's a really unfair final question for you, Kelly. I ask a lot of people this. Is there a standout piece of leadership advice that you've given or received in your career that is front of mind for you now?
I think the biggest tip for leadership would be to really care about your people in the organization. I can't think of anything that's more important than that. And there was a remember there was a session when I was becoming a squadron commander. You kind of go through this course in the Air Force, but it was called Caring Leadership. And that and I thought, wow, because I remember, yeah, when I have a leader, the most important thing to me is that they actually care, and that I know they care, and they show that. And it doesn't mean being overly, affectionate or that kind of stuff. It just means you're deeply involved, and you're concerned, and you understand, and you're there as things progress for good or bad, and you're vested in it just as everyone else is. So I think, yeah, to show and actually care about the people and the organization.
Well, I love that, because that is indeed another one of the eight components of human-centered leadership. So it's wonderful that we've been able to have this conversation. Listen, Kelly, you've been an absolute star for jumping on this call. And I know it's early in California, and having this conversation before you head off for a well-deserved break. I just want to say a massive thank you, and I hope you've enjoyed this conversation.
Yes, it was great. I really did. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Kelly, and safe travels wherever you go. Who
Right,
knows?
thanks.
Take care. Thank you.
Bye.
Join us again next week for more curiosity and insight with the Leadership Enigma. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show, as well as suggestions for future topics and guests. Get in touch with me on LinkedIn or visit us at www.leadersenigma.com. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe on all your major podcast platforms and on our dedicated YouTube channel. Thanks again for joining the community.